Thank you very much, Helen. And I came along armed with something I wrote in 2001 for the Tax Law Review Committee about this topic. And Helen's just said to me, I was still at school. So I feel really old now. And I do feel as if I have been pushing this for a very long time. And Stuart, I know, sitting here in the audience, will remember explaining this risk point to me very, very carefully, because the Tax Law Review Committee started with the view that with very different views, but you will not be surprised to hear that I really agree with everything that Helen has just said. Other than that, we can be agnostic about employment rights, because I do think that we have to think about employment rights, and if we are going to have any hope at all of selling some kind of change after what happened last week, we are going to have to come up with a package which looks at the problem holistically and comes up with a big review. But I don't think that means that the answer has to be the same across the board for employment law, tax law, and social security law. We know now that the answer is supposed to be the same answer. We have case law, which is supposed to be the same case law. In practice, it's not. In practice, when cases get to an employment appeals tribunal, they are treated differently from cases that go to a tax court. And that is because the cases are very, very fact-based. We also know that there are statutory... Oh, I should have gone to my slide. We know that there are statutory variations and exceptions, for example, to the usual rule for national insurance for cleaners and examiners and so on. And we know that there are special cases where we have had to have statutory intervention like IR 35 and the construction industry scheme. So we haven't got the same solution across the board anyway. And in addition, we have the complication that in labour law, we have not only the self-employed-employed divide, but we also have another category of worker, which is what the recent cases, Pimlico Plumbers and the Uber case, have been about. And that further confuses the issue. And if workers can have different employment law rights from employees but pay the same national insurance, I think we start to see that the argument that we have to have the same solution across the board has already broken down, but is not breaking down in a coherent way. And what we have to do is try to be coherent about any deviations that we are going to have. So I think we need to start by looking at what the aims and objectives of each different piece of law are, and then try to find solutions for that particular problem. So labour law is designed to protect those who are in an unequal bargaining position. We want to protect those who can't protect themselves by contracting. And the state, therefore, imposes obligations on employers through statute. But the final relationship that is regulated is a relationship between the engager and the engaged. It may be mediated by the state, but it's a relationship between those two people or those two organisations. We may also want to have labour law in mediating or intervening, because it will be more efficient to provide protection for employees through insurance, for example, if that's done by the engager, by the employer. But none of that has anything to do with tax, as Helen was explaining. That's the contract between two people, the engager and the engaged. And so we need labour law that will do that and do that well. And the colleagues that I'm working with in Oxford are writing about the way in which that should be done, and certainly do not believe that the distinction between employees and workers is very useful anymore. So we need to get rid of that distinction, and hopefully the Taylor Review will propose that, because it makes no sense. But what we're going to have to focus on is how much protection does the particular person need? And we may have to do that by looking at how long they've been working for a particular person, what the relationship is, how close it is, and how unequal the bargaining position is. The aims and objectives of tax law are obviously very different. Obviously, we want to raise revenue, but we want to do that in an efficient way. And so withholding tax from employees is an efficient mechanism which reduces costs and also reduces evasion and avoidance, the PAYE system, so beloved of the revenue. But beyond that, what else do we want to do? Helen's already spoken about this, but do we want to provide incentives to work in a particular way? If we do, there is absolutely no reason why those incentives should depend on the legal form. And we wrote these slides separately, but we've got very similar answers here. Target the incentives, not to the legal form, but to whatever the market failure that you're dealing with is. And here the important point I want to make is that the relationship is between the taxpayer and the state, and the engager is simply a tax collector. So that's a different relationship from the employment law relationship. And I will just mention VAT here as well. VAT is a transaction tax. It's beyond me to understand why the legal form should be of any relevance. And why is it relevant? Only because we have such a high threshold. So if you look at the Uber case, for example, the reason that it matters whether the driver is employed or self-employed for VAT purposes is because he or she will argue that they are below the threshold and therefore do not have to collect VAT if they are not employees, whereas if they were employees, VAT would be collected. Now, there should be some way of getting around this by using Uber as a platform, which wouldn't necessarily have to redefine those people as employees. For other tax purposes, it doesn't need to link. It could just be a withholding device. I think it would help a great deal to massively reduce the threshold, and I know that goes against the Merlis review. And I know that many economists think we should have a high threshold, but in my view, the threshold has become much too high in the UK and is a cause of a lot of non-compliance, shall we say, and lack of a level playing field. The aims and objectives of social security law, again, that's a relationship between the individual and state, as it is for tax law. Partially now, it's exactly the same, whatever you are, an employee, a self-employed person, a worker, whatever, certainly around pensions. I've just been in Sweden, and I was trying to find someone who could talk at a conference we're organising, an Oxford conference, about comparative perspectives on this problem, and they could not understand what I was talking about because they don't have a difference between the amount of social security that's collected from the employed and the self-employed. It is possible to have a system, and many countries have a system, where there is no difference. Now, we do have some differences, but I understand now that they're being examined over the summer as part of the Taylor Review, or perhaps separately. Who knows? But they're being examined. As I said before, the fact that workers have slightly different rights but are still paying the same national insurance contributions just shows how silly this argument is, that there has to be an exact... that it has to be coterminous, because what we should be doing is thinking, what rights do we want to provide for our citizens? How do we assess how much we are paying them? And then work out how we should do that rather than linking it to the particular form in which they're working. And I agree with Helen, other issues that have been raised in the debate constantly, sick pay. Well, that's the responsibility of the employer, as I've just found out with my PA who's broken her wrist. that people have written to me about their inability to get mortgages because they're self-employed. I'm really, you know, that's bad, but that's nothing to do with the tax system. And it's a market issue which is not for tax or social security to solve. I have here, and you may not be able to see it, but this is from the UK Gov website, and it shows what rights workers have. And it's really confused, because it shows that even the government is saying workers are usually entitled to this and workers may be entitled to that. And then lower down, although I haven't copied it, it says workers... how do you know if you have a worker? It depends whether you pay national insurance for them, which is a totally circular way of describing it. And I am not surprised that Philip Hammond had such trouble getting his change through, because it is actually impossible to find any clear statement of what the different rights are and how it works. But we do see that workers are not usually entitled to statutory redundancy pay, for example, and only sometimes will they be entitled to statutory sick pay, statutory maternity pay. It's all very unclear. So thoughts for discussion to finish off my section of this and to throw out to the audience. The idea that the gig economy presents some radical departure seems to me to be nonsense. We've had these problems for a very long time. There are no new issues, but it does highlight the problems. And it might also give us technological opportunities to deal with the problems, for example, by withholding using a platform. So that would be the main reason why we should be looking at this, at the gig economy. And I'm arguing that we should think at least about detaching the withholding obligation from the employment definition completely. Using technology to achieve the aims of tax law by providing a platform for withholding income tax so that that no longer distorts the employment law. We do not want two distortions which are both pushing in the same direction, tax and employment law. I think we can align social security rights further to get rid of that problem. Ooh, and my final point has gone. Oh, it's gone off here. Somebody didn't like it. At reducing the VAT threshold, we must have a self-employed person operating this. The picture's gone from my screen. And I just finish by saying, making myself completely unpopular, that might be something we could do, looking at it together with making tax digital. If people are going to have to make more frequent returns, shouldn't, and they're going to pay on a cash basis, shouldn't we be thinking about one set of returns on which they could pay? Perhaps there's a completely new tax we could have for them, which would not actually be called VAT or income tax. And then it would be very much easier to sell the whole package because it would all be completely new.